Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, one of the most important battle spaces, though it is getting less and less attention by the day, is that involving Sharia supremacists determined to accomplish what other enemies of our country, who are getting rather more attention, seek as well, which is global domination. A man who covers this beat very capably and comprehensively is our first guest. I'm pleased to say a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, as well as the director of a superb online resource of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, Jihad Watch. And that would be, of course, Robert Spencer. Robert is the author of, well, almost innumerable books at this point, including among them a couple that he has published for the Center for Security Policy Press about mass migration in Europe and Islamophobia and the threat to free speech. Robert, it's always good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
Thank you. Particularly, I'm anxious to get your take, Robert, on one of the things that has been the ultimate fool's errand, as far as I'm concerned, namely the determined effort that a bunch of folks who did the same darn thing in the Obama years have been beavering away at since they came back to office in the Biden administration, namely some kind of deal, so-called, with Iran, aimed at ostensibly curbing the mullah's longstanding nuclear ambitions. What is the state of play in that regard at the moment, Robert, and the prospects for it actually doing anything to restrict the bomb that the mullahs, as I say, have long aspired to have?
Well, Frank, we have to remember that the original Iran deal from 2015 did not actually restrict Iran from getting the bomb. It only postponed their getting the bomb for 10 years and even allowed them various ways that they could get it before those 10 years were up, because under certain circumstances, they were allowed to inspect their own nuclear sites, which made the whole thing a farce. And now there are numerous reports that the new deal is even worse than the old one. And there are a number of reasons for this. One of them is that we're not actually negotiating with Iran at all, because Iran refuses to deal with the great Satan. And so we are dealing with Iran through an intermediary. And this just is unbelievable to me. The intermediary is a Russian diplomat named Mikhail Ulyanov. Now, I ask you, what are the chances that Mikhail Ulyanov, who works for Vladimir Putin, is going to get us a deal favorable to the United States? That seems to me about nil. But nonetheless, the Biden administration has outsourced our negotiations with Iran to this gentleman. And in an interview just a few days ago, Ulyanov said that Iran was negotiating very tenaciously, that they were arguing over every comma and every word, and that they were getting virtually everything that they wanted. And that not only was Iran getting virtually everything that it wanted, but also China, which he called his co-negotiators, were getting what China wanted. And so this looks as if it's going to be a deal that is absolutely disastrous for American interests and beneficial to the Islamic Republic of Iran and to Russia and China as well.
Let's come back to some of the particulars. But just again, Robert, we have some history here. And I'm reminded of a famous comment attributed to our European allies with whom we were back in the Obama years negotiating with Iran, that John Kerry, who was at the time the Secretary of State, was acting as Iran's lawyer in these negotiations, holding forth, demanding concessions from the Europeans that even they recognized were ill-advised, in Kerry's absolutely monomaniacally focused effort to get a deal with Iran. It sounds as though this is happening again, perhaps in spades. What do we know about the nature of the concessions that are being handed out to the Iranians, for starters, let alone the Chinese?
Well, for one thing, it looks as if that the Iranians are going to be allowed to keep these ballistic missiles that they have directly threatened Israel with already, and that their nuclear ambitions will probably only be restricted in cosmetic ways. As a matter of fact, Ulyanov made kind of a Freudian slip when he was talking about how tenaciously the Iranians were fighting, were negotiating. He said, Iranian clerics are fighting for Iranian nuclear national interests like lions. And so I thought that was very telling. We don't know all the details yet, but as we've said here, it doesn't look like it's going to be anything good for the United States.
And China, of course, is a beneficiary, if in no other way, if Iran, gets out from under sanctions, or if Iran is given still more billions of dollars, or if Iran is otherwise legitimated and empowered by this deal, China's become an ally of Iran. It's also buying oil from Iran in large quantities, in violation of the present sanctions, by the way. So all of this presumably would redound to the benefit of China in the abstract. Is there anything else that's more directly beneficial to them that we know is in the mix at the moment?
Not that I know of, but I can tell you that China is working to gain hegemony, economic hegemony over all of Central Asia, the whole area of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. And they've been very effective in moving into Afghanistan in the absence of the American troops there, and are working closely with Pakistan, which very notably has refrained from criticizing the Chinese genocide of the Uyghurs. Meanwhile, the Afghans, the Taliban has assured the Chinese that they will not allow Uyghur activists to take refuge in Afghanistan. And now with Iran, it's looking as if China is going to be the most formidable power in that entire region. And that, of course, significantly boosts its global interest.
And again, this seems to be the purpose of American diplomacy at the moment, is to grant that kind of status to the Iranian regime, notably by what it's been doing, the Biden administration, that is, to I think that's the technical term for it, dis the Israelis on the one hand, and to undermine in numerous ways our other relatively friendly nations in the Persian Gulf, the Saudis notably, and I guess the UAE as well. Robert, again, to what end? What is it that this administration thinks will redound to the benefit of American interests that these allies are, demeaned? In the case of Saudi Arabia, we literally took away missile defenses that they needed to protect their oil facilities and people from Houthi rebel missiles made in Iran, it seems. And, again, that's not just demeaning, that's endangering our allies. But what is the theory of the piece here, as you see it?
I think that it's absolutely short-sighted, and that it doesn't really have anything to do with America's interests at all. It's all about vindicating Barack Obama vis-a-vis Donald Trump, Barack Obama concluded the Iranian nuclear deal. It was the centerpiece of his foreign policy. He boasted about how effective it would be. And then Trump said that it was the worst deal ever concluded by an American president and that he would roll it back immediately, which he did. And so in an incredibly partisan and short-sighted manner, the Biden administration is now trying to restore Obama's legacy by returning us to an even worse deal. And as you noted, the Saudis are furious. The crown prince, who is effectively the ruler of the country, wouldn't even take a call from Biden over the Russia-Ukraine matter. And he said that he didn't care what Biden thought. And this is a low, you know, the Saudis, of course, have there are a lot of problems, of course, with that regime as well. But the idea that the United States is now fully committed to empowering Iran against the Sunni states is going to be trouble for the United States, as well as for the region and the whole world at large.
Well, and again, this comes as the against the backdrop, Robert Spencer, as you know so well, of the Biden administration now scrambling to try to check the very dramatic increase in gasoline prices at the pump. And rather than endearing themselves to the Saudis, they seem to be intent on endearing themselves not just to the Iranians, but the Venezuelans, no less. The common denominator here seemingly being it's only okay to exploit and sell, and for that matter, for us, buy fossil fuels if they come from hostile powers and not from friendly ones, let alone American producers themselves. Again, it's just hard to understand the basis upon which one can argue this is all in the United States' national interests, let alone national security ones.
No, I don't think there's any way that you could possibly make a case for that. And it seems as if the Biden administration is operating completely on the basis of short-sighted and narrow partisan interests. Not only do they want to vindicate Obama vis-a-vis Trump, but they have to placate the Greens, who make up so much of the Democratic Party's base at this point. And so they'll do anything but revive the domestic oil industry that Biden immediately destroyed or severely harmed when he became president. Instead of working to restore its efficiency and its ability to supply our energy needs, and remember, we were energy independent up until the beginning of the Biden administration. Instead of doing that, it seems as if aiding any hostile power will do. Because the Greens don't care about that. They always think it's America's fault when a power is hostile to us anyway, but they do care about not having a domestic oil industry.
It's a wrecking operation, I guess, is what I keep reverting to. And whether it's for partisan reasons or ideological reasons or simply an animus against this country, I'm not sure. But whatever it is, it's not good for those of us who love the place and who live here. That's for sure. Robert, let me turn quickly to the Sunni side. We've been talking about the Shiite jihadists in Iran. Turns out there are some on the Sunni side of the sectarian divide within Islam, as you know, best of just about anybody. I want to come back to the Taliban. You touched on them a moment ago, but just an update on a story we discussed last week as it was in Prospect. A chap by the name of Mohammed Mani Ahmed Al-Qahtani. Give us a sit rep on him and what it might mean for this jihadist enterprise.
Yeah, this is an interesting individual. He was captured in the Battle of Tora Bora late in 2001. And it was discovered not long after that that he had come to the United States, flown into Orlando, Florida, in August 2001. And none other than Mohammed Atta, the leading 9/11 hijacker, was waiting in the parking lot of the Orlando airport to pick him up, apparently. But he didn't have much money on him. He didn't seem to have any prospects in the United States. And so the customs official was suspicious, and he was sent back to Dubai, where he had flown in from. And so it's generally assumed that he was going to be the 20th hijacker. A lot of people have been called the 20th hijacker, but Al-Qahtani seems to have the best case for it in participating in the 9/11 attacks. In any case, once he was picked up there in the Battle of Tora Bora, he's been in Guantanamo now for 20 years, and he's just been freed, sent back to Saudi Arabia, where he will supposedly undergo mental health treatment. Now, this is, I think, highly suspicious because something I've tracked at Jihad Watch over the years is the common tendency of authorities in Europe as well as in the United States to consign virtually every jihad attack to mental illness. And again, I see, particularly in France and Germany, some jihadi screaming Allahu Akbar, stabbing random people on the street, and then he's taken to a psychiatric hospital because the authorities are so intent on proclaiming that this could not have anything to do with Islam. And it's not possible that anybody could be inspired by the texts and teachings of Islam that mandate violence against unbelievers, that they figure, well, this guy must be mentally ill. And that's all there is to it. And so I think that this decision to send Qahtani back to a mental institution in Saudi Arabia is redolent of that kind of denial.
Robert, it's one thing for non-Muslim nations to exhibit such ignorance of Sharia and what it commands. But surely the Saudis are under no illusion about the conformity with the dictates of Sharia that this individual has exhibited. Is it going to be a mental rehabilitation or the kind of re-education program that the Saudis have told us they would subject these folks to in the past?
Initially, it was announced that he would be going to a de-radicalization program in Saudi Arabia. However, when he was freed, there was no mention of that. And so the only thing they were saying was that he would be getting mental health treatment. I think this is another example of something being perfectly acceptable in Saudi Arabia that's illegal in the United States and elsewhere. What he did in fighting for the Taliban is not something that most Saudis would think there was anything wrong with. And there are many indications.
To the contrary, it's actually divinely ordained as something you're supposed to do, is it not?
Precisely. And so it's likely, I think, that after some brief period, he's going to be freed with no conditions whatsoever.
And no perceptible rehabilitation either, I'm fairly sure. So he'll be back at large, presumably, and who knows, back in the fight as well. Robert, very quickly, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you, since we've talked about the Taliban a couple of times, I understand from our friend Sam Faddis at andmagazine.com that the Taliban is also back in the fight, is now taking credit for some acts of jihad in Pakistan. What can you tell us about that quickly, and what does it, again, portend, especially since we've given them whatever it is, 80-some billion dollars worth of rather high-grade military equipment with which to engage in not just, you know, prosaic forms of jihad, but presumably on a much larger scale?
Well, you know, once again, this is something that the Taliban said they were going to do. And I reported at the time that the Taliban took over and the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan was concluding that there were several Taliban officials who said quite openly that they were now going to expand their jihad to the neighboring countries. And so this isn't anything that we couldn't have seen coming. And yet, of course, we didn't see it coming, or the Biden administration refused to see it coming. And so now we're dealing with the consequences. But this is there's no surprise in this whatsoever. It's just the Taliban's pursuing the concept of jihad being something that is waged against the entire world and not just limited to one country.
Even fellow Muslims, where they think it's necessary for their purposes. As we'll be following that, I know, closely, as will you, Robert Spencer, because it if they're going to do that to fellow Muslims, you can bet they're going to be doing a lot of it to the rest of us. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and your great work, both with us at the Center for Security Policy and, of course, at jihadwatch.org. I commend it to all of our listeners. We'll talk with you again soon, Robert. Godspeed. Next up, we'll speak with John Mills, retired United States Army colonel, about allegations from China and Russia that the United States has had all kinds of biological warfare research going on all around the world. What's that about? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to one of our next guests. He is one of our favorite guests as well, John Mills, retired colonel in the United States Army. He has served his country in uniform with great distinction in special operations units. He is specialized, among other things, in psychological warfare. He is also an expert on cyber issues and served in the office of the Secretary of Defense for a time in a civilian capacity, with responsibility for that portfolio on the policy side. He is a valued member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and a senior fellow, I'm proud to say, at the Center for Security Policy. Colonel Mills, it's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome.
Frank, always an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Okay, let me ask you, I was hearing yesterday that the Chinese government, I think with a sort of amen chorus from the Russians, formally charged the United States with operating not just scores, but hundreds of covert facilities around the world, engaging in biological warfare activities. You have spent a lot of time in senior positions in the government, and I think may be able to shed light on what it is they're talking about and whether there's truth to the charges as rendered.
Yeah, Frank, what this is all about, information warfare and information operations. We are in a non-shooting World War III. China's the senior partner, Russia's the junior partner. What China did yesterday was essentially seize upon the long-standing Nunn-Lugar Act, also known as the Soviet Nuclear Threat Reduction Act of 1991. This is a long-standing program that was created with the best of intent, as are all government programs. But simply put, the whole purpose of and it's also known as the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. The whole purpose of this essentially was you had a huge nuclear, biological, and chemical stockpile in the Ukraine, also Georgia, also Azerbaijan, Belarus, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. Huge nuclear, biochemical stockpiles, and unemployed scientists trying to feed their families. This was a program initiated to essentially get these under control, get these extremely dangerous substances under control, and make sure these scientists are not providing for their families by working for bad people. That was 91, almost 30 years ago. So what the Chinese are doing in classic PSYOP propaganda is seizing upon something we've been doing for 30 years and creating and portraying it as some kind of evil infrastructure. Now, everything they do, they automatically assume we're spying. I would say 99% of the program was, as stated, in a constitutional, functional society, we always want our intelligence community to be aggressively pushing the envelope with strategic competitors or enemies. We want them. If we are operating in a constitutional America where the intelligence community is operating as a constitutional construct. But the Chinese and Russians, because they're so perverted and so they think everything we're doing is a spy operation, because they're the inverse. Any of their programs are 99% spy, 1% do stuff. Ours was 99% do stuff, 1% I'm not going to speak to. So this is the problem. They've seized upon this as a propaganda point. And we just need to be, you know, this is the Nunn-Lugar Act from 91. Like it or not, this is 30 years been in public law.
So the adage, no good deed goes unpunished, comes to mind here. You're saying, John Mills, that there have been quite a number of these facilities that have been operating under some kind of U.S. sponsorship and supervision, but not for the purposes of doing biological weapons research, or let alone activities, you know, supportive of biological warfare, but to try to prevent that sort of thing from happening. Is that right?
Well, yeah, the bio warfare defense, and this is the nuance, because the deep state has lied so much everything, especially about Wuhan, Fauci, and the American role in Wuhan. They've lost all trust, and now anything looks like bio offensive bio warfare, which is gain of function, which is what Wuhan was doing. Now, the bio treaty that many of the countries, including China, has signed, allows defensive bio research. There, as you and I have studied, there is a significant difference between offensive and defensive bio warfare. They look totally different. But to the layperson, because of the lies of the deep state, everything is just getting blurred together. Were some of them doing defensive bio research, which is totally allowable? In fact, a good thing, in accordance with the bio warfare treaty. I think probably there was some of that offensive that shouldn't have been. I hope not. I doubt it. But they've seized upon it as a propaganda point. And we have to treat this as this is a propaganda warfare game.
And I guess effective propaganda, and as a trained specialist in psychological operations, you understand this better than anybody, John, often has a grain of truth to it. And the grain of truth in this case is that we do have, and have now for quite some time, and in a pretty public way, tried to make sure that this huge infrastructure that the Russian, previously the Soviet Union, had that was authentically used for weapons of mass destruction, offensive related research and development activities, whether they're nuclear, whether they're chemical, whether they're biological warfare. Is that right? So that we can stipulate to that. The question is that something that was ongoing with U.S. subventions from the taxpayer in an illegal and dangerous way, namely biological offensive?
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer is I don't believe they were doing offensive bio. When this first started coming out last week, people were shouting, and I think it was purely Russian disinformation. And we must be vigilant, just as we're vigilant against the deep state and aggressively going after the deep state. We cannot fall prey to Russian and Chinese propaganda. And people were portraying Putin as the great savior of all of us, and that he was doing great things by taking out these offensive bio labs last week. That is a lie. And was somebody moonlighting at these labs and doing things they weren't supposed to be doing? I don't know. I don't think so. But Putin is not our savior. He is not the enemy, but he is not our friend either. And we must always be vigilant of the difference, and just not, I think many, there was many people on, I would say, our side that were falling prey to this and portraying him as this was some kind of, the Crusades, and that, he was actually doing the right thing. You know, hey, Putin attended some of these world forums too with Soros. So, you know, he mingled and commingled at some of these events also. Putin is a career KGB operative. So I apologize, but he has decades of track records where he is thuggish, and, you know, he is going to push unlawfully advantage for the Russians. I spent almost 40 years. It is my sworn duty, and anybody who takes the oath of office as a civilian or in uniform, we're going to push the envelope lawfully and always make sure America has an advantage. That's our sworn duty. But we're going to play by the rules, and we're going to be lawful. They have no lawful bounds. They're going to do whatever they want to do in Russia and China.
John, let me come back to something you said a moment ago, that Putin is not our enemy. There are those who strongly agree with that, and have, in fact, as you've suggested, indicated that he should actually be on our team against a common enemy, namely the Chinese Communist Party. But there are others who are, of course, of the view, especially in the aftermath of this Ukraine invasion, who insist that he is unabashedly the enemy of the West, including the United States. And the axis that he formalized back in February with Xi Jinping and have, reaffirmed now, both of them repeatedly since, makes him actually member the other team for sure. Walk us through your sense of the nature of the man, and more to the point, the nature of the relationship we should
assume. Well, we blew it in the 90s with the Russians, and I will point, the Biden team, the blue team, always needs an enemy for everybody to just get deranged, angry about, whether it's Trump or Putin or whatever. They always need somebody to go berserk over. So they're ideologically off the unsalvageable. You can't talk to them. We missed the boat in the 90s, and Madeleine Albright seemed to take it upon herself to, when the Russians were on their knees, when the country was devastated and destroyed in the collapse of the Soviet Union, by merely extending our hand and agreeing to work with them and help, just help them, whatever that meant, that could have changed the world dynamic. Instead, Madeleine Albright made it her choice to just brutally kick them in the teeth and ignore them during the 90s. Putin remembers that. Coming forward to more recent times, they have chosen to be on the other team. Russia is a much bigger and stronger country than Ukraine, and they have attacked the Ukraine. It should be enduring policy across administrations that we do not support a bigger, stronger country crushing a smaller, weaker country. That's what's going on. I am not defending the Ukraine. They are corrupt too. A lot of problems, a lot of linkages to Biden, a lot of issues. But the reality is Russia is brutally attacking Ukraine. My view is send them a stockpile to the border, and they pick it up at the border, of Stingers and Javelins, and have at it. We want to provide equivalency so the Ukraine is not utterly crushed, because Russia is on China's side. The problem is we got somebody in the White House who is compromised. We have a problem. The countries do not respect us. And this whole MiG-29 flop with Poland reflects the utter amateurish, ideologically crazy behavior of the current administration, where Blinken essentially was goading Poland to cross the red line and receive a hard punch from Russian returns, while we just stood aside and said, "Oh well," and so the Poles very wisely jujitsued this and said, "Hey, you know all these MiG-29s? They're now U.S. property. We're sending them to a U.S. airbase in Germany. Whatever you do with it, that's on the U.S." Very wise of the Poles, because the insidious, ideologically crazy behavior of Biden, of Blinken, the political appointees, and a lot of the careerists, unfortunately, at state, the Poles don't trust us. Nobody trusts Biden. Everybody knows he's not a man of his word. And I tell you, Frank, I've lived through so many international negotiations under both Trump, Obama, and Bush, the countries prefer Trump. They prefer Trump.
This is a really incredibly important point. I assume, John, that you have, as do I, low expectations of Vice President Harris's diplomatic mission to the Poles and to the Romanians and NATO more generally under these circumstances. And again, it speaks to this issue of trust. And just, if you would, John, sort of a concluding thought, my fear is that what we've increasingly seen and given reason for is that the calculation in large numbers of places around the world is that it is better to be America's enemy than its friend.
I don't know what else to say here, Frank. The ideologically deranged behavior and alternate universe that the Biden camp resides in is just astonishing. And anybody on that side who is ideologically sound, I mean, and is intellectually open-minded, needs to call it out and leave that camp, because these countries see Biden, Harris for what they are. No moral values, no moral starting point, cannot be trusted. They have this ambiguous, unclear view of a perfect world, and just will try to will everybody toward it. But they don't give specifics. They don't give guidance. They don't give actionable way ahead. And in negotiations, they can't be trusted. I have been burned at the White House on National Security Council, where one of the Obama appointees, we'll have a meeting. You've been through these, Frank, at the White House. We'll have a meeting. It was unclear what was decided, a lot of dispersed opinions. And then the Obama team, now the Biden team, will put out an after-action memo and say, hey, everybody agreed to this. No, we didn't. No, we didn't.
John, we have to, I think, leave it at this. We're in a dangerous world in which, as you say, Russia and China are increasingly joined at the hip, albeit the Russians as the junior partner. The Chinese are the far bigger threat to us, obviously. Are we at risk in our preoccupation with Russia at the moment of missing that larger threat and perhaps enabling it to metastasize further?
Absolutely. Because of the pronounced lack of trust and confidence by other countries, and including our strategic competitors, as the Biden team likes to call China and Russia, we are giving a green light to world chaos. This leadership from behind with vague ambiguities, Obama, John Kerry, John F. Kerry, you know, lecturing, is a green light to world chaos. And we need the leadership of Donald J. Trump to provide America. These countries desperately want American leadership. So this leadership from the grant, from the bleachers, this leadership from the third balcony, where we're just kind of powerless observers. After a while, these countries say, "Well, you know, the United States has checked out. We gotta cut our own deal," and that's what happened. And that's what triggers the rest of World War III.
Separate pieces or outright betrayals or piling on, all of that is definitely in prospect. John Mills, your insights as well as your long service to our country in so many different capacities, including that you're now rendering with us, among other places, at the Center for Security Policy. And Newsmax, by the way, I want to commend you for your now continuous loop there. It's very heartening to see you shedding light on all of these issues, and we're appreciating, as always, your time with us today. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Scott Powell, the author of Rediscovering America, a very timely and much-needed corrective. Be right back with you after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and I couldn't be more pleased to welcome to these microphones a man who, well, we haven't ever talked to, I think, here, but if not, it's certainly been a very long time. Long overdue is a catch-up with a friend and colleague of many years. His name is Scott Powell. He has been an entrepreneur. He has been a think tank denizen. He is an author, most recently of an important new book, Rediscovering America, and an essayist of considerable productivity. We're always pleased to have a chance to touch base with him, even if it's not been on air, certainly for a very long time, and most especially here in the aftermath of the publication of Rediscovering America. Scott, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Oh, Frank, it's a delight. It really is. You're doing great work there.
Well, thank you so much. As have you for a very long time. And I wanted just to sort of calibrate for our audience about something that I remember from, well, decades ago now, which was a book that you wrote called Covert Cadre, which was a very eye-opening treatment of an exemplary enemy within institution, the Institute for Policy Studies. And I wanted both to commend you for that early work and the illumination that it provided about the phenomenon that, yes, Virginia, there are enemies within the United States, and that certainly seems, if anything, to be vastly more true today than back in the 70s. And I thought maybe we might just start with that as topic A. Discuss, if you would, both the founders and other prominent leaders of this country, like Abraham Lincoln, who worried about the problem of enemies within our country as a real threat to it, and how you see that manifesting itself today.
Well, I think it almost goes without saying that an open society, a free and democratic and open society such as we have, we are the freest, really the most open country have been in the world, that we're very vulnerable to penetration. So the fact that we would have enemies living within the United States working against our system should really come as no surprise to anyone. And one would hope that the role of the FBI and the CIA would be to thwart those enemies. But unfortunately, the cultural transformation that's been going on really since the 1930s has borne such fruit that we now have our country turned against itself. Leadership agencies, the administrative state, the FBI, the CIA is utterly corrupt.
And in fact, to the extent that they see enemies within, we're told they are, people like us, I guess, conservatives, people who, you know, admired and supported Donald Trump, people who believe in the Constitution of the United States, gun owners, veterans, and the like, domestic terrorists, we're being told, school folks in the various school boards across the country. And to the extent that you see, Scott, the national security agencies of the United States really being weaponized against such law-abiding, peaceable, patriotic Americans. It is really an example. You called it, I think, the cultural transformation. It's, I would say, a Marxist takedown of our country, using critical race theory and other divisive and even racist techniques for sundering this republic. No,
I agree, but I would say this: that just as the nomenclatura of the Soviet Union, that is, the elites in the Communist Party in the highest levels, they really didn't believe in Marxism. Marxism was a tool for control. It was a justification for their privileges and their control over society. And the same is true today in America. These are all just ploys to control us, to confuse, deceive, and control us.
And unfortunately, they have found a receptive audience in, among other places, teachers' unions, and as a result, an awful lot of proselytizing. Again, not just about sort of socialism as a theory, but about ways in which it can be converted into a vehicle for taking down this constitutional republic, which brings me to Rediscovering America, your splendid new book. Talk a little bit about the sort of concept behind it and how it really sheds light on the character of this exceptional nation and reminds us of why we must resist these efforts to take us down from within or without, for that.
Well, we have a remarkable country. We're like no other country in the history of mankind. You know, there have been other states of cultural achievement, virtue and efflorescence, for instance, Athens under Pericles, Florence under the Medicis, England under Elizabeth and Shakespeare, but none of those countries were founded as America was. America is the only country in the history of mankind that was founded on ideas and principles, and those ideas and principles came right out of the Bible. And those are very powerful ideas and principles, because They're the principles of our creator. And when we conform and live by those principles, life goes better. So our country really flourished, not because of government, but because government was limited and people were free. And so we had this incredible economic growth in America, driven by the entrepreneurialism and the motivations of the people and the virtue of the people. That, you know, is now threatened. You know, we've dumbed down our people. We've seen Christianity marginalized from our culture. I mean, driven out of our culture, but really marginalized in every way. And what, you know, our greatest hope right now is that we really have a great awakening. And so I think the positives of what we've gone through with COVID and what we're going through now is that people are seeing the fraud, they're seeing the deceit, they're seeing the corruption, and that can prompt them to make the next step, which is to really engage in a full-fledged cultural and spiritual revolution. And that and politics will follow.
You are using terms that sound somewhat akin to the Great Reset. And yet I know that you appreciate those who are championing both that term and an agenda that it describes have something very different in mind than, you know, returning America to its founding principles and extolling its virtues and building anew the kind of America that has served both its own people and the world so well for so long. Talk a bit about this Great Reset. Who is bringing it to us, and what do they have in mind instead?
Well, I'm not an expert on all of this, but I think what anyone can find out is what an organization like the World Economic Forum, what they believe, what their vision is, and what they're doing. And that's an organization founded by Klaus Schwab. And they're quite public about their vision and their goals. And they want to see the abolition of nation states. They want to create a global order. And of course, these elites would be in charge of that global order. And people will own nothing and they will be happy. Of course, it's absolutely ridiculous. But they certainly have marshaled a lot of elites in governments and academia and have gained a lot of credibility, surprisingly enough. So it is a threat. It's hard to know how it would all get consummated. And I don't think it will get consummated. I think that we still have a residual in America that really represents the greatest hope to avert this transformation into a secular, really a global totalitarianism. We're already seeing signs of it in America, right? We live now in cultural totalitarianism, and we don't like it.
Yeah, yeah. And we will like it less and less as it metastasizes into other aspects of our lives. Let me ask you, Scott, because it often comes up in conversation on this program and elsewhere. To what extent are the globalists of the Davos crowd, if you will, making common cause with the Chinese Communist Party? And do they have the same end state in mind? And if they don't, how do they think this is going to sort out at the end of the day?
That is a really good question, Frank. We know that Klaus Schwab is on record saying that of the systems of political economy, he felt that the Chinese model was the closest to the best that could be seen in the world. So that's a real indicator that there may be a joining together, but it's very hard to know how that would sort itself out. As we know, with communists, it's like a mafia type government. And there isn't any tolerance for anyone that wouldn't toe the line. So my guess is that Klaus Schwab is no match for Xi Jinping.
That's my feeling too, that at the end of the day, it will be the communists, not the capitalists, albeit the post-modern, post-sovereign capitalists who will prevail. Scott, just in terms of the challenge that you see at the moment in the education of the American people about the true character of this country and the exceptional nature of it, yes, but also the indispensability of it. Beyond your own book, and this is an important contribution, what is your recommendation for how we restore a sense of both appreciation for and gratitude about our bequest, so that we in our time, as Ronald Reagan used to say, will rise to meet the existential threats we're facing to freedom at home and abroad, and be able to bequeath to our children a land of the free and home of the brave as well?
Well, that's a very big question, very big undertaking. I think, though, that whether it is the media or it's our public school system, these organizations need to be allowed to continue to decline, and people need to opt out. You know, we need to create replacement institutions. So homeschools, of course, are doing that. I think the homeschool movement has gained a lot of momentum and will continue to do so. I think, you know, we have this very robust alternative media, of which you're a part, Frank, and I really appreciate all that you're doing. I have to say that you're one of my heroes. So keep up the good work. We're going to have the birth of Truth Social fairly soon. That's going to be, you know, Trump's social media that can replace Facebook. You know, when you consider truth versus falsehood, in which way are we going to bet? I'm going to bet on truth every time. So I believe that this great awakening that we're having and needs to continue to gain more momentum will be the victor. But how it all plays out, it's very hard to know. And you know, we want to have as few casualties as possible. So we need to protect our children and train the next generation, because you know, they're going to be in the forefront of a rebirth of this country.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Scott Powell, and more to the point, from your book, Rediscovering America, to their ears, I hope we will find this really important work being used as a vehicle for inculcating in that next generation both the appreciation and gratitude for this country that it so urgently needs as well as deserves. Scott, I hope you'll come back to us with frequent updates.
Yes, I'd love to.
If you will, it's great to have a chance to talk with you, and you're at the cutting edge of the intellectual fight for our freedoms, and it's deeply appreciated. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the Discovery Institute, and we'll talk with you again soon. I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.